Okay, so we are in Exodus 22. And if we remember last week, what did we talk about? Exodus 21. Does anyone remember? Yes, okay, so the beginning is laws for Hebrew slaves. And we talked about how we cannot. Yes, God values life. So, which command was chapter 21 mostly centered around? Yes, thou shalt not murder, thou shalt not kill. Okay. Command six. We found out that being a slave could be a very good thing, and we cannot think of biblical slavery as modern or historical American slavery. Okay, the two do not correlate. God's rules for slavery made it was possible for slavery to be a good thing, and we talked about how their slavery was more like our military, joining our military. Okay, so you're locked in for a certain amount of years, and but once your term is done, then you are set free. You are not, God did never condoned a person owning another person for life. Okay? So yes, and then we talked about how God values life and what kind of life does he value? Everybody's. Who are the examples of lives that people don't normally value? The unborn, right? What did you say, Britt? Slaves, right? So men, women, slaves, the unborn, children, all life is valuable. God does not distinguish one life as more valuable than another. Okay? So if you killed an unborn baby, what was the punishment? Death. You die. Okay? Because it's the same, killing an unborn baby is the exact same thing as killing an adult, okay? Or killing a child or killing a slave. All is worthy of the death penalty. Okay, and then even if your animal kills someone else, right? We talked about that, those laws. Okay, so you are responsible for your property, and if your property has been violent in the past, right, and you do nothing to restrain your ox or whatever, then you deserve to die as well. However, if it's the first time and you didn't know, then right, you had to make the ox died, but you did not die. Okay? All right, so that was chapter 21. Chapter 22, we're going to continue the law. And here in Exodus, right, we're going to get the law basically just in three chapters, 21, 22, and 23. Okay, then we're going to get later on how to build the tabernacle. But these chapters, 21 through 23, are a very short exposition on the Ten Commandments. You get a much longer exposition on the Ten Commandments in Leviticus. Okay? But all these laws relate back to the Ten Commandments, and we need to keep that always in mind that these are not just random laws. Cindy! Oh, I don't know if she can hear us yet. Yeah. Okay. We'll wait. Can you hear us, Cindy? Not yet. There she is. Can you hear us, Cindy? Good morning. Okay. All right. Okay. So, chapters 21 through 23 are an exposition of the Ten Commandments. Okay, and we talked about how the Ten Commandments is kind of like Israel's constitution, and now we get specific laws kind of like our federal law. Okay, the idea behind all these laws is that every action in your life is intentional and theological. There is no area too small that God is not sovereign over. Okay, so God is going to talk about all these different circumstances, but the main idea behind it is that he is sovereign, he rules your life. Israel was to be totally different from the nations surrounding them in how they dealt with all these cases. Okay? Things that were acceptable in other nations are not going to be acceptable in Israel. The way slaves are treated in other nations are not the way slaves are treated in Israel. Why? Because God is the one in charge of Israel. He is the one making the laws, and there is a theological reason behind each law. Okay? God is showing his sovereignty and his care for his people with these laws. They were Israel. I mean, the point of Israel, right, was to be a kingdom of priests. So their lives were supposed to be holy and distinct. And they were to be an example to others, to the nations around them. Okay, so God's holiness was to permeate even the smallest details of their life, how they treat their slaves, what they do when they lose something, something dies, what they eat. There was no detail too small. And when asked why, they were supposed to be able to give the theological reason behind it, right? And we too should be the same, where we look at these laws and we're like, well, the laws of our land are very different than these laws. God's holiness and righteousness should still dictate all the small areas of our life, and we should be able to explain why we do the things we do, especially to our children, right? We live this way, right, because we serve God and we love God. Doesn't matter that the neighbor down the street does it different, right? This is the way we live because of the God that we serve. We're going to talk about the structure of chapter 22 really quick before we get started. Okay, we're going to see if you look at chapter 22. Okay, if you look at it, verses 1 through 17. Each law starts, well, at least in the NASB. Each law starts with if. Verse 1, if. Verse 2, if. Verse 5, if. 6, if. 7, if. 10, if. 14, if. 16, if. Okay, do you see that? Then look at verse 18. 18, 19, 20, 21. Right? Those all start with something different. You shall not. Whoever lies, he who sacrifices, you shall not. Okay? So there's a change. And then you look back at verse 25. If. We're back to if again. Okay? So this is a chiasm, which we see often in Scripture, and it often things were written this way because it helped them remember. Okay, this was a memory technique where you have similar things on the outside and something different in the middle. Okay, so verses 1 through 17 are going to deal with theft, which is command 8, thou shalt not steal. Okay, and all the variations of theft. What?
With your neighbor.
Yes, yes.
Deals with your neighbor.
Yep. So verse 18 through 24, right, is going to be command 7, thou shalt not commit adultery. Okay? And then again, verse 25 through 27 is going to again deal with theft. Okay? Command 8.
Misha?
Yes. Yes.
Different translation. But only verse 25 starts again with if. Do the rest of the verses in that chapter in your translation start with the word if?
No, it's just 25 through 27. It's very short. Yeah, so it's we have a long treatise on theft, then we have adultery in the middle, and then we just have like one more law about theft at the end. Okay? Yeah, good question. Because then verse 28 starts a different chiasm that goes all the way through chapter 23. Okay? Verse 28 is going to deal with commands 1, 2, and 5. If we remember, you shall have no other gods before me, don't have idols, and 5 was honor your father and mother. And when we talked about the Ten Commandments, we talked about how those were parallel. You have to honor God's authority and honor human authority because God put it in place. Okay, so 28, if you look at it, you shall not curse God nor any ruler of your people. Okay, so that's command 5. Then in verses 29 through 31, so the rest of chapter 22, we're going to get command 10, do not covet. Then into 23, verses 1 through 9, chapter 23, verse 1 through 9, it's going to be command 9, do not lie. And then again, 23:10-21 is going to be again command 10, do not covet. And then verse 22-26 is commands 1 and 2. So basically you have command 1, command 10, command 9, command 10, command 1. Okay, a chiasm doesn't just have to be 3. It can be any number of things, but the emphasis is what is in the middle. Okay, so that's the structure from 22 into 23. And as you can see, each grouping of these commands is, of these laws is dealing with a different command of the Ten Commandments. So to begin with, verses 1 through 17, we're going to deal with theft. And we're going to see that the way God deals with crime is very, very, very different from how we deal with crime today. Okay? God's emphasis is going to be on restitution, paying back in multiples of what you did wrong, not jail time. Okay? In the Old Testament, people didn't get thrown in jail. They either died because the crime was so bad that they deserve death, so they get the death penalty, or they have to pay restitution. There are four advantages. Well, I'm sure there are more, but I'm going to list four advantages of restitution. Okay? First, the victim is more generously and more immediately compensated. Restitution was to be made immediately. This was not something that was dragged out for years and years and years. Okay? So once someone was found guilty of theft, they owed restitution immediately. Okay, we're going to find out what happens if they can't afford it, if they can't pay it. Okay, but the victim is compensated immediately, and so this whole matter is put to rest quickly. It doesn't drag on for forever. Okay, two, the offender, so the stealer, the thief, has to deal directly with the victim and face the effects of his crime. Right? This is not, you don't just get to ignore the victim and think that their life is just the same. No, you had to deal directly with them in making restitution. Okay? So you could see the harm that your crime had caused. Three, it permits a repentant offender to deal with the victim and get on with his life. Okay? So if the thief is repentant, he has the opportunity to make restitution and then just continue his normal life. The crime has been dealt with. He has been punished. It is over. It is done with. It does not drag on and on for years. Okay. And then number four, society does not have to provide food, clothing, shelter, you know, for this criminal for years and years and years. Right?
Can you repeat that?
Number four. Yeah, I can hear him as well. I don't know.
Yeah, me too.
Yeah.
Somebody probably needs to mute their thing.
Yeah. Sorry. We'll do the best we can. So number four is society does not have to provide for the criminal. So in our way of doing things, the person goes to jail, and then it's up to the taxpayers to provide the housing, right, jail, food, clothing, provide for this criminal throughout their jail sentence. If the criminal has to pay restitution, he's responsible for himself the whole time, okay, and not a burden on society. Okay, did everybody get that? Questions? Yes, number three is it permits if the thief is repentant, right? Or if not, even if not, it allows the criminal, the thief, to move on with their life. They pay restitution, and then that crime is over and done with. It's been dealt with, and on they go. And they get to continue their life, hopefully as a contributing member to society. Okay? So hopefully, but the punishment of paying restitution has taught them their lesson, and they can go on with their life. It doesn't interrupt their life for years and years on end. Any other questions?
I'm so sorry. Can you also repeat number four? I was trying to figure out how to mute my phone.
Yes, that's fine. Number four is basically society doesn't have to provide for the criminal. Okay, so like for us, if somebody goes to jail, right, is the taxpayer's responsibility now to provide everything for that person because the taxpayer money funds the jails, the prison system. Okay. So with restitution, there's no one in jail. That person is not a burden on society. Okay. And again, like I said, either your crime basically was bad enough that you deserved the death penalty, so you were killed, or you had to pay restitution. There was no prison system. Okay. Good. Any other questions? All right. Can somebody please read for me verses 1 through 17 of chapter 22?
Surely make restitution. If he owns nothing, then he shall be stole for his death. If what he stole is actually found alive in his possession, whether an ox or a donkey or a sheep, he shall pay double. If a man lets a field or vineyard be grazed bare and lets his animal loose so that it grazes in another man's field, he shall make restitution from the best of his own field and the best of his own vineyard. If a fire breaks out and spreads to thorn bushes, so that stacked grain or the standing grain or the field itself is consumed, he who started the fire shall surely make restitution. If a man gives his neighbor money or goods to keep for him, and it is stolen from the man's house, the thief is caught, he shall pay double. If the thief is not caught, then the owner of the house shall appear before the judges to determine whether he laid his hands on his neighbor's property. For each breach of trust, whether it is for ox, for donkey, for sheep, for clothing, or for any lost thing about which one says, this is it, the case of both parties shall come before the judges. He whom the judges condemn shall pay double to his neighbor. If a man gives his neighbor a donkey, an ox, a sheep, or any animal to keep for him, and it dies, or is hurt, or is driven away, while no one is looking, an oath before the Lord shall be made by the two of them that he has not laid hands on his neighbor's property, and its owner shall accept it, and he shall not make restitution. But if it is actually stolen from him, he shall make restitution to its owner. If it is all torn to pieces, let him bring it as evidence. He shall not make restitution for what has been torn to pieces. And if a man borrows anything from his neighbor and it is injured or dies while its owner is not with it, he shall make full restitution. If its owner is with it, he shall not make restitution. If it is hired, it came for its hire. And if a man seduces a virgin who is not engaged and lies with her, he must pay a dowry for her to be his wife. If her father absolutely refuses to give her to him, he shall pay money equal to the dowry for virgins.
Okay. So this whole section, 1 through 17, is all dealing with different forms of theft. Okay. Some are going to be more deliberate than other forms of theft. Some's going to be more theft through neglect. And we're going to end with theft of something that's not even physical. Okay. Not a physical item that you own. Verses 1 through 6. These are acts of commission. So actively doing something wrong. Okay. And these laws, remember, we talked about last week, I believe, that the way Israeli law worked is different than the way our law works. Okay. In our law, we have to be so careful to try to include every kind of scenario in the wording of our law so that no one can find a loophole out, right? In Jewish law, it was more the judges were able to extrapolate the principle of the law and then apply it to various situations. So it was more of a, you violated the spirit of the law. I mean, like for verse 1, if a man steals an ox or a sheep and slaughters it or sells it, he shall pay 5 oxen for the ox and 4 sheep for the sheep. someone can't steal a donkey and say, well, the law doesn't apply to me because it only says ox and sheep. No, it doesn't work that way. Okay. Ox and sheep are just examples. Right. The principle behind the law is you don't steal anything. And if you steal, you have to pay back multiple. Right. So if it's a donkey, the judge then gets to determine how many donkeys you have to pay back. Okay. Somewhere between 5 and 4, you know, or I don't know. But the judges had that discretion. They could do that. But because the law was not totally comprehensive in all the examples, didn't mean you got away with it. Okay. Okay, so this verse 1, this deals with very intentional theft, okay? And the thief is caught, okay? And the theft is intentional because he has either slaughtered it to eat it or he has sold it, okay? So the animal is gone, okay? You can't get that animal back. Then if it's an ox, you have to pay 5. And remember, we talked last week, the oxen were very expensive. Okay, a lot of people didn't own them and then had to borrow someone else's or rent somebody else's that had one. So if you steal an ox, which was very valuable, you have to pay back 5. That's a hefty fine, right? A sheep, you had to pay back 4 sheep. Now, why do you have to pay back more if you steal an ox that's more expensive than a sheep that's less expensive? Okay, God's law looks at more of the harm caused to the owner than to necessarily just the crime itself. Okay, theft is theft. But if you steal an ox, you are causing more harm to the owner. The owner would use the ox probably on a daily basis to farm his farm. You probably, well, typically only had one. I mean, I suppose if you were wealthy, you might have multiple, a very large farm. But he would not be able to do the work that he needs to do to provide for his family because he no longer has an ox. So you have stolen something that is of more value. Therefore, the punishment is greater. If you steal a sheep, right, people typically had more than one sheep. And they were not used, you know, they weren't technically valuable to the owner until shearing time or slaughter, whatever, if you're going to eat it or make clothes out of it. So you could lose a sheep for a longer period of time and it would not cause as much harm to the owner than losing an ox would. An ox would impact you on a daily basis, whereas a sheep may not. Okay, so the ox, you had to pay back 5. The sheep, you only had to pay back 4. Does anyone remember later on in the Old Testament, when we have this return to the 4 sheep, you steal a sheep and you have to pay 4 back. Does that ring any bells?
Isn't that the
parable of Nathan to David? Yes. Yes. So Nathan, 1 Samuel 12:1-6, Nathan comes and tells David a story, right? A poor man had 1 sheep. And the rich man had a guest. So what does he do? He steals the poor man's 1 sheep. And David's response is what? Well, he's mad, but he says what? You have to do what? He has to pay back what?
4 sheep.
And it's just very interesting that David knows the law well enough that he knows specifically the consequence for stealing a sheep, right? Back here in Exodus, the consequence for stealing a sheep was you had to pay back 4 sheep. And yet he had just broken the law, right? Thou shalt not murder and thou shalt not commit adultery. And so he had committed greater transgressions of the law, you could argue, and yet he knew the law down to the minutia of knowing how much sheep the rich man should owe the poor man because he stole his 1 sheep, okay? So David knew the law well, and that was Nathan's whole point, right? He says, you are the rich man, and David, to his credit, responds well and responds in repentance, okay? Verse 2 through 3, this deals with what happens to a thief if he robs you basically at night or during the day. If the thief is caught while breaking in and is struck so that he dies, there will be no blood guiltiness on his account, but if the sun has risen on him, there will be blood guiltiness on his account. Okay, so this in our laws today, There's also a similar distinction whether you're robbed at night or during the day, whether it's burglary at night or breaking and entering during the day. And the idea behind this is at night, you're more disoriented. You can't see, especially back then, right, with no electric lights. You might strike out against the intruder, but your strike is going to not be as precise because you can't see. You would have no idea if the intruder has a weapon or not, because again, you can't see. It is not reasonable to expect you to react calmly. Also during the day, you're more likely to be able to call for help because other people are awake. And you can be more careful with how you take down the intruder. Okay. So if you killed him at night, right, your intent might not be to kill him, but if someone is stealing from you at night and you strike at him and he dies, you are not guilty of his blood. Okay, because he shouldn't have been there in the first place. That was his responsibility. And you are defending, you know, your family. But if it's during the day, then you need to be careful and you are not allowed to kill him because theft is not a capital crime. Okay, there are capital crimes. Theft is not one of them. Okay. The property owner is still allowed to defend himself and his property during the day. He just needs to be more careful about it. Okay? And again, the judge could extrapolate this and to take into account all different kinds of circumstances. Yes, Rita.
Okay, if you can see at night, then what is the thief doing in there? You know, if he can't see at night.
Right. I mean, it's like today. We have thieves come into our house. It's just a lot harder to see. Maybe he knows exactly where it is. Maybe a lot of times they kept their oxen penned up in their houses at night, in their courtyards. You know, so you don't have to see too much to be able to know where the oxen is, right? It's big enough. So maybe he's come to steal something like that. But for whatever reason, you know, I mean, even today, burglars work mostly at night because you are asleep. And even though they can't see very much either, there's enough, you know, maybe it's a full moon and there's enough light that they can see something. But the owner of the house is not as responsible as he would be during the day when he can see and none of his senses are, you know, disarmed or, he can see clearly. Good question. Okay, then the second half of verse 3. He shall surely make restitution. If he owns nothing, then he shall be sold for his theft. Okay? God is saying there is no excuse for theft. None. Poverty is not an excuse for theft. Remember, we dealt in chapter 21. What was a really good way out of poverty for the Israelites?
Going into slavery.
Going into slavery, right? Contract slavery where they would work for 6 years, and sometimes it was so good that they just stayed a quote-unquote slave for life, an employee for life. So there were legitimate ways for the Israelites out of poverty. Theft was not one of them. Okay? This law here makes theft, it seems like theft has higher consequence for those who are poor. Okay, because if you're rich, you might be able to afford the restitution. You might be able to pay the 5 oxen or the 4 sheep out of your surplus. But then the thing is, why would you be stealing in the first place? If you have 5 oxen already that you can give back to the person. Okay, if you are poor and you cannot afford 5 oxen or 4 sheep or whatever the judge determines your restitution is, you are sold into slavery. Now, one thing we need to remember, God's law never contradicts God's law. So we cannot take one law out and read it all by itself, right? We've already talked about what was most slavery in Israel. How long was it for, typically, most of it? 6 years. 6 years, and then you got released on the 7th year. So you cannot take this one verse and say, oh, this slave then is owned for life. No, okay, because we've already established what slavery is. So in this case, the slave would have to sell him, or the thief would have to sell himself into slavery. The master who bought him for 6 years would then pay him, and he in turn would, out of that money, immediately have to make restitution. Okay, so he gets his lump sum for working 6 years. And then he would have to take that and translate it into five oxen or four sheep or whatever the restitution was. If the restitution did not take all that money, he got to keep the rest of it. He only had to pay his restitution. Then he had to spend the next 6 years working it off. Okay, but then he would get released on the seventh year. So this is not God condoning selling someone into slavery for life to make restitution. Okay, but again, the victim was quickly and immediately restored. Okay, and even more than restored, because they had been harmed, so they get more than what they originally had. Okay, but we have to remember, God's law never contradicts God's law. Yes, Rita?
What if they can't afford it?
Can't afford what?
To pay the restitution.
Well, that's what I'm saying. Then they would sell themselves into slavery. They had to. They had to. That was the law. If you steal and you cannot afford it, you have to afford it. So in our terms today, it'd be like you have to take out a loan. But back then, selling yourself into slavery, there was more insurance that you would actually pay it back. You know, today if you took out a loan, people just default on their loans, okay? Back then, you sell yourself into slavery, you get a lump sum at the beginning, and then you have to work it off the rest of the 6 years. Well, you don't even have that money anymore, most of it, because you have to make restitution with it. But then you work it off over the 6 year term. Okay. All right. Verse 4. If what he stole is actually found alive in his possession, whether an ox or a donkey or a sheep, he shall pay double. Okay. If you have not disposed of the animal yet, or the goods, whatever it is, okay, the restitution is less. And the idea behind here is, if you have not even had the time to dispose of the animal to either eat it or sell it, this theft has probably very, very recently occurred. And so the owner of the animal has not been harmed as much. Okay, there has been less harm if the owner is without an ox for 1 day as opposed to the owner is without an ox for a full week before the thief is caught. Okay, so you still have to make restitution, and it is still in multiples. It is double. Okay, but the owner gets his original animal back, which, you know, even for the owner, maybe he has his ox trained really well. And yeah, he gets five more oxen, which is great, but now he has to go through the work of training them to be, you know, do what he wants. I don't know. I don't know that much about animals, but maybe the owner, you know, has a specific affinity for this animal. So if he can get his original animal back, that is the best scenario, because he gets back what is his own, and then he also gets double on top of that. Okay. So God wants true justice, right? And he acknowledges in his law that not all cases are the same, and not all harm is equal. And so his law seeks to make those differentiations. So that the owner gets justice, but also so that the thief is not punished more harshly than he deserves as well. All right. Verse 5. Okay, verses 5 and 6 deal with things that are not quite so deliberate. This is not I'm going and breaking into someone's house or property to steal something that is theirs. This is less deliberate. Okay, than the acts of theft that we just dealt with. Verse 5, if a man lets a field or vineyard be grazed bare and lets his animal loose so that it grazes in another man's field, he shall make restitution from the best of his own field and the best of his own vineyard. Now, these two are both going to still be acts of commission, right? Something you do, because in verse 5, the owner is letting the animal loose on purpose. In verse 6, you're going to have a fire set on purpose. Now, part of it is you do something on purpose, part of it is negligence, right? So, you have no grazing land, your animal is hungry, so you just decide to turn him loose. Well, now he wanders into someone else's field and ruins their field. No one who is smart, right, is going to let a grazing animal near their vineyard or their field because they know they're going to ruin their crops without being tethered. Okay? So your animal is hungry, but instead of trying to figure out a better way to feed them, you just let them wander loose and now he destroys your neighbor's crops. Okay? So this is theft. Okay? It's not deliberate theft. You didn't go in and steal the grain yourself, but you allowed your animal to do it. Okay, so you have to make restitution. You are still responsible for your animals. And what does God require of you? What is the restitution?
Giving the best of his own field or his own vineyard.
That's right, so it's the best. And now the judge would probably have to determine the amount based on how much damage, right, your animal did. But you didn't just get to give, you know, I don't know, he ate a bushel of grain, so I'm going to give you a bushel of grain, right? No. The restitution probably was more than what the damage caused, and it had to be of your very best. So you lose the best of your crop because you were irresponsible and let your animal wander into someone else's field to cause them harm. Verse 6, same idea. If a fire breaks out and spreads to thorn bushes so that stacked grain or the standing grain or the field itself is consumed, he who started the fire shall surely make restitution. Okay, so you're starting a fire and it gets out of control for whatever reason. Now, when you start the fire, it is not your intent to burn someone else's field. It is not your intent to quote unquote steal from someone else, but you started the fire. So you are responsible, okay? And you have to make restitution, and most likely you also have to pay the best of your crop, just like in verse 5, okay? So those are both acts of theft that are not quite as deliberate, but God says you're still responsible for what you do, okay? So we have to take care in all our actions that we are not inadvertently stealing from someone else. Okay, verses 7 through 15, these are acts of omission, okay? Not deliberate, but you didn't do something that you should have done, okay? You didn't take proper care. So you're not necessarily deliberately trying to steal, but because you did not do something that you should have done, another person suffers loss, okay? 7 through 9. If a man gives his neighbor money or goods to keep for him and is stolen from the man's house, if the thief is caught, he shall pay double. If the thief is not caught, then the owner of the house shall appear before the judges to determine whether he laid his hands on his neighbor's property. For every breach of trust, whether it is for ox or donkey or sheep, for clothing, or for any lost thing about which one says, "This is it," the case of both parties shall come before the judges. He whom the judges condemn shall pay double to his neighbor. The ideas behind these laws is if you are watching over somebody else's property for whatever reason, you borrowed it, the person is going out of town and needs you to watch his animals, whatever, you are assuming responsibility for it. Okay? Verse 7 is the easiest. If a man gives his neighbor money or goods to keep for him and it is stolen from the man's house, if the thief is caught, he shall pay double. Okay? So this is easy. It gets stolen out of your house. It really is stolen. The thief is caught. Okay, you don't have to do anything. The thief then has to make restitution of double, has to pay double. More difficult, right, is verse 8. If the thief is not caught, then the owner of the house shall appear before the judges. Now, so this is basically a he said, she said, right? You give your neighbor money to watch for you or goods, okay? He says, oh no, they got stolen. But the thief is never caught. You have no proof. You don't, who is to know who is telling the truth, right? Is it really stolen or did you steal it, right? Are you just hiding it or you damaged it and you don't want to be responsible? Okay. So the original owner of the goods would be suspicious, to say the least, you know, of the neighbor and say possibly you just stole it from me. Okay. What was interesting I found in these verses is where, does anyone, let's see, it says verse 18, if the thief is not caught, then the owner of the house shall appear before the judges. Does anyone have any other translation besides the judges?
Yeah,
8.
Yeah, verse 8.
Yeah.
Okay,
nope.
The Hebrew...
Mine has a note that says, or God.
Yes, the interesting thing is the word in Hebrew is Elohim. The party shall appear before Elohim. Okay, now they've chosen to translate it the judges, but it could just be before God, because God is the one that knows the heart. God knows what truly happened. And if you look down in the next section at verse 11, they have to take an oath before the Lord, and there Yahweh is used. Okay? So probably in this situation too, you had to take an oath before the Lord. I did not steal this man's goods. Okay? They really were stolen from me.
Yeah, my translation says before God in verse 8.
Okay. That's ESV, right, okay? They would have to take an oath before God and then let God act. Now God is the decider, and obviously he knows who's right and who's wrong, okay? This idea of swearing something before God and letting God deal with it carried through all the way until the time of Solomon. Okay, so this is not just Exodus. If we go to 1 Kings, can someone read for me chapter 8, verse 31 and 32? So 1 Kings 8, 31 and 32.
Judge your servants, condemning the wicked by bringing his way on his own head, and justifying the righteous by giving him according to his righteousness.
Okay, so this is Solomon praying and dedicating the temple. Okay, but even here, you know, it's because Israel was a theocracy, right? Especially at the beginning, where there wasn't even a king. Okay, so in certain cases, God was the one to be the judge. Okay, so they would come and have to swear before God whether they, you know, did or did not, which they would be swearing to their innocence. They did not take or steal. Okay, if both parties fear God, the seriousness of having to swear an oath before God would drive the guilty party to confess, theoretically. Right? Because if you lie, you know that God knows you lie, and now you're inviting the judgment of God. Okay? And if you could not either swear the oath, or you finally said, yes, I did steal it, then you owed your neighbor double. Okay? End of verse 9. He whom the judges condemn shall pay double to his neighbor. Verses 10 through 13, if a man gives his neighbor a donkey, an ox, a sheep, or any animal to keep for him, and it dies or is hurt or is driven away while no one is looking, an oath before the Lord shall be made by the two of them that he has not laid his hands on his neighbor's property, and its owner shall accept it, and he shall not make restitution. Okay, so this oath was so serious that you had to believe the person who took it. Okay, there was, if he swears before God that he did not take your things, it says you have to believe him. Okay, the owner shall accept it. He shall accept that oath. Of course, right? We're like, but he could be lying, right? I mean, that's very easy. They're just words to say, okay? So he could be lying, but if he lies, God knows it, right? And he is now inviting God's judgment. And if you truly fear God, it is far better to make restitution than to invite God's judgment. Okay? If he is not willing to take the oath in the first place because it's so serious a matter, then he is basically admitting his guilt and he has to make restitution then. Verse 12. But if it is actually stolen from him, he shall make restitution to its owner. Okay, so if it really was stolen and he can't, because remember the caveat that verse 10 was that if it dies or is hurt or is driven away. Now, if you're watching over someone's animal and you're negligent and the animal is stolen from you, well, when you received that animal, you assume responsibility for it and you need to return it back to its owner. So if it is stolen from you, you are responsible for it and you need to pay it back to its owner. But then there's one more caveat, verse 13, if it is all torn to pieces, let him bring it as evidence. He shall not make restitution for what is torn to pieces. So if the animal was attacked by another animal, killed, torn to pieces, you're not responsible because this is a quote unquote act of God, right? You're not responsible for all the wild animals out there. Okay, but this was not another human stealing it, or you didn't do anything. I mean, you could if it's a sheep, right, you could be very well watching over the sheep as best you can, and it can still be attacked by a lion or a bear and torn to pieces. And then you're not responsible for making restitution, so long as you can prove that that is what happened. Okay, that you can bring the remains of the animal to the owner. Okay, verse 14 through 15. If a man borrows anything from his neighbor and it is injured or dies while its owner is not with it, he shall make full restitution. If its owner is with it, he shall not make restitution. If it is hired, it came for hired. So when you borrow something, there is the assumption that you will return it in the same condition that you got it in. Okay, if you can't, you have to make restitution. But there might be cases where you borrow it, but the owner is still responsible for it. I need an oxen to work a day in my field because I'm too poor to have one. The owner might say, okay, you can borrow my oxen, but I'm going to be the one that drives it, you know, walk behind it or whatever. So if the owner is there and he still has responsibility over the animal and something happens to it, right, the owner is the one responsible. Yes, you needed that animal to work your field, but the owner is there, he's still responsible for it, so you don't have to make restitution for it. If it is hired, it came for its hire. So the idea is that if you had to rent an animal, in the rental price, there would be an amount for quote-unquote insurance for the animal. So you have already paid to use this animal for a day or a week or whatever. If something happens to it, well, the owner is going to have to be satisfied with the money that you have already paid for it. Okay, so then you don't owe restitution, which remember, restitution was like double. It was payment on top of payment. Okay. Verse 16 and 17. If a man seduces a virgin who is not engaged and lies with her, he must pay a dowry for her to be his wife. If her father absolutely refuses to give her to him, he shall pay money equal to the dowry for virgins. Okay, so we read these verses and we're like, how in the world does this have to do with theft? Okay. Verses 1 through 15 seems more clear to us how it deals with theft, but this is theft as well, okay? But they are transition verses, because if you remember verse 18, we're going to start dealing with adultery, okay? So 16 and 17 are transition from theft to adultery. However, these verses really do deal with theft because the man is stealing several things. One, he is stealing the virginity of the woman, which in those days was much more highly prized than it is today, okay? And he is stealing the bride price from her family, okay? And we see that theft here can be of more than just a physical thing. Stealing a virginity from a woman is basically destroying her life, okay? Especially in that culture, okay? But that's not something that's tangible. It's not, you know, money or an animal. And then he's also stealing the bride price from the family. Marriage in the Bible is a formal covenant, and the sign of the covenant is sex. Okay? Sex makes you one flesh and married virtually, even if you are not legally or properly married, if you're not betrothed or married through a proper ceremony. Okay, and this principle carries through to the New Testament. This is not just an Old Testament idea. If we go to 1 Corinthians 6, okay, Can someone read for me verses 15 and 16? 1 Corinthians 6, 15 and 16. Verse 15 and 16.
Do you not know that your bodies are members of Christ? Shall I then take the members of Christ and make them members of a prostitute? Never. Or do you not know that he who is joined to a prostitute becomes one body with her? For as it is written, the two will become one flesh.
Okay, the two become one flesh, right? God uses that in terms of marriage. So Paul is saying we cannot just join ourselves with prostitutes and say that's not a problem. No, it is virtually marriage. Now, yes, you are not legally and properly married to that person, okay? But it is, sex is not to be viewed just cavalierly. It is doing something. It is making you virtually married to that person, okay? So back in Exodus, if there is sex before a proper marriage, the family is due the bride price regardless of whether the couple gets married or not. And this is why, okay? We think of bride price often as, oh, how terrible, you're just buying a woman, okay? But that was not the way they thought of a bride price. The bride price actually honored the woman and showed that she was of great value, okay? It was not selling her as property. The bride price required the husband to be, the groom, the fiancé, to take it very seriously and enter into negotiations with the family. Okay, so the family is involved. The husband to be has to think long and hard. He has to plan. The bride price was not just a piddly sum. I was talking to Kyle last night, and he said it could be equivalent to our like $400,000 today. Okay, so this was a significant amount of money. This was not just a piddly amount. And you tend to value more something that costs you greatly. Okay? So the bride price elevated marriage because it cost you something. It cost the husband something. So then he's going to love and cherish this wife because he had to pay a lot of money to get her. Okay? Sex before marriage devalues the woman and shows blatant disregard for her worth. Because it's saying, I'll take you in marriage and I'll not even pay a penny for you, okay, to your family. So that is basically saying you're really not worth anything, okay? Now, verse 16, he has to pay a dowry for her to be his wife, okay? And we might say, you know, here it says if he seduces her. So here it's unclear whether the woman is a willing participant or not, okay? Deuteronomy expounds it. Extends this, I think, to include rape as well, okay? But the woman does not have to become his wife, okay? Verse 17, if her father absolutely refuses to give her to him. So if this is just a wretch of a man, the dad has the opportunity to say, no way, I'm not giving my daughter to you, okay? There's no way she's going to be married to you. But because of his acts, because of his blatant disregard for the woman or for the woman's family, he owes a bride price. He has to pay for her whether he gets her or not. And like I said, this is not just a piddly amount. So it is unlikely that a man would be able to afford two bride prices. So if he has to pay a bride price for this woman that he slept with and they weren't married, and he doesn't get her as a wife, it is unlikely that he's going to be able to afford to pay another bride price to another family to be able to get a wife. The father, the family, is due the bride price because now who has to take care of the daughter for the rest of her life? The father, right? The family was supposed to be able to give their daughters to someone else, and then now she was their responsibility to take care of. Well, now, in that society, you weren't a virgin. The chances of you getting married ever again are slim to none, basically none. So now you are going to be single the rest of your life and you needed to be provided for. So the man who did this, he is responsible to pay the bride price regardless of whether he gets her as a wife or not. Questions? What?
Who gets the bride price?
Oh, the family. The family, the father. The father of the daughter. So either he gets the bride price and the daughter becomes the wife of this man. Okay? Or the father gets the bride price and says, "No, you're not getting my daughter," and then she stays at home and he can use that money to provide for her the rest of her life. Okay? That's a great question, because I always wonder with all these laws if Israel ever followed any of them ever. I mean, because we know God commanded, right, that every 7 years or 70 years the land lie fallow, you know, and not to plant it. And we know they didn't do that, because that's why they went into exile, so that the land could rest for all the years that they didn't allow it to rest. So I don't know, you know, we can see through God's laws that he sets them up to be fair and just and treat, not judge too harshly, you know, but provide for all these different circumstances. Now, whether Israel actually carried them out properly, that's a whole nother question. And I don't know if we know specifically. We just know that they mostly failed, you know. So were there good judges that would uphold these laws? I'm sure there were in different periods of Israel's history. But even once you get into the kings, I mean, God's law gets totally lost and they don't even know it's there, right? Until they find it like in a back corner of the temple. So we know that Israel fails greatly in this. So yeah, great question. I don't know. And yes, Solomon, yeah, how he could afford. Now, some of those were political alliances, so, you know, with different countries, so maybe they didn't, you know, it was just enough that there's now a political alliance. I don't know. Yeah.
Did you say make sure that the father determines the price, right?
Yes. Yes. Well, so typically, I believe the husband-to-be, normally, right, in a good situation, would enter into negotiations with the family and they would settle on a bride price. So I don't think it was like an exact amount for everybody.
Right, because I know, I mean, when you were saying equivalent to our 400,000, I'm thinking, holy cow,
right.
Like, how many people do we know who could even afford
right,
that?
Right,
you know,
right.
But, yeah, anyway, all right.
Right, but so it wouldn't necessarily be the same for every family, you know, if it's a poor family marrying another poor family. It probably wasn't as exorbitant, but the idea is that it was, regardless, a significant amount of money. It wasn't just, hey, here's $10, take my daughter. Yeah. Any other questions on theft? Okay. And I think we can see that God's ways are better than our ways. You know, and unfortunately, the way we do things here in America is not like this, but, you know, I don't even know if the way they did things in Israel was exactly like this either, but, you know, we can see that God in his wisdom rules the best way. Okay, can someone read for me verses 18 to 31?
To my people,
Okay, so verses 18 through 24 are going to deal with adultery, command 7. Okay, don't commit adultery. The big idea behind don't commit adultery is don't mix things that don't go together. Okay, so adultery, you are with your husband or your wife. You do not mix with somebody else's husband or wife. Those things don't go together. They were never meant to go together. Okay? And also, we're going to see all throughout the Old Testament, God compares Israel's infidelity, right, to with their worshiping of other gods. Okay? So their worshiping of other gods, selling themselves, believing in something else, that is God always compares to Israel being unfaithful, to being the prostitute, to committing adultery. Okay, so here we have verses 18 to 20. We have sorcery, so the occult, bestiality in verse 19, and polytheism in verse 20. Okay, and notice, they all deserve the death penalty, and it is hugely emphasized. You shall not allow a sorceress to live. Whoever lies with an animal shall surely be put to death. He who sacrifices to any god other than to the Lord alone shall be utterly destroyed. So three different ways God says these people have to die. All three of these things deserve the death penalty. Okay? All three substitute something else for a covenant relationship with Yahweh. Okay? Again, the emphasis is they have to die, because if you let them live, they are going to pollute your covenant community. If they choose to substitute something else for the covenant relationship with God, they need to be gotten out of there, because they're going to impact other people. So sorcery, this is spiritual adultery. You are not allowed to mix paganism and holy living. Okay, and sorcery really is taking man's opinions, man's trickery, right, and saying, I believe in that instead of God. Now, we might think today, oh, we don't really practice sorcery, right? I don't believe in the whatever it is, the zodiac or whatever. Okay, so we don't really do sorcery, but the idea here is you cannot take any of man's opinions and replace them for God's truth, right? You have to believe what God says and God says alone. Man's opinions, man's trickery, they are not a basis for our belief. Okay, we cannot mix man's opinions and godly living. And Christians all over the world try very hard to do this. Okay, we got to make evolution marry into the Bible somehow. Okay, we got to add this in. Okay, no, the idea is you accept God and God alone, you believe in God and God alone, and what he has revealed and what he has revealed alone. Man's opinions have no place. Okay. 19, bestiality. Whoever lies with an animal shall surely be put to death. Okay, this perverts Yahweh's covenant and his design, right? This is not God's design for man. Okay, man and women. Also, bestiality was associated with various Canaanite fertility practices. Okay, so this is not just, okay, gross, who would do that? This is basically practicing another religion where they believed that, you know, that to get their crops to be fertile or get the rain to fall from the sky. Remember, in Israel, rain is very important. And so the religions there did everything they could to make the land fertile, right? And you need rain, so you would do whatever you could to encourage the gods to send the rain. Okay, so bestiality was part of their fertility practices. And so Israel might very well be tempted to join in these practices to get the gods or God, maybe they even thought Yahweh, to send the rain. Okay, so this is more than just, ew, gross, who would do that? This is a could be also a religious practice as well. Okay, so you can, I mean, sorcery is a religious practice, bestiality could be a religious practice, and then obviously verse 20, he who sacrifices to any god other than the Lord alone shall be utterly destroyed. Okay, this is obviously accepting any other god. Okay, and if you remember, we learned in command 1, you shall have no other gods before me. We didn't say, okay, that means you have to you put Yahweh at the top, and then you can have it whatever other gods you want underneath it. No, it's God and God alone. So here also, it's God and God alone. You can't just worship Yahweh as the preeminent God and then worship all these other gods beneath him. Okay, if you sacrifice to any other god, if you worship any other god, then you are to be destroyed. Okay, and remember, the punishment for adultery is also going to be death. Okay, the punishment for adultery was death. So the punishment for spiritual adultery is also death. Okay. Verse 21, you shall not wrong a stranger or oppress him, for you are strangers in the land of Egypt. You shall not afflict any widow or orphan. Okay? What in the world does this have to do with adultery? Okay, the idea, right, adultery is that there are things that don't mix. Okay, holy living, godly living, covenant with Yahweh, and anything, sorcery, bestiality, polytheism, those things do not go together. They do not mix. Okay? So Israel might very well think, hey, there's a Gentile among us. We get to treat him badly because he's not part of the covenant community. Gentiles and Israelites do not mix. And what does God say? You shouldn't wrong them or oppress them. Why? For you were strangers in the land of Egypt. You have to remember the Exodus. You were not holy. God is the one that made you holy. So you do not get to turn around and treat someone else as unholy because they are a Gentile. Because why? God can make them holy. Because it had nothing to do with you, Israel. It had nothing to do with you. Remember... Oh. Even throughout the whole Exodus, Israel is protesting, right? They don't want to be saved. As soon as they get out of Egypt, all they do is grumble and complain, okay? They didn't want to be delivered, and God delivers them. So they do not get to turn around and say, oh, you Gentile, you're beneath me, okay? They are to live out an Exodus theology that God is the one that delivered them. God is the one that made them holy, and that hope is there for the Gentiles and the strangers as well. Okay? Wrong. So in verse 21, you have wrong and oppress. Verse 22, afflict. All three of those are synonyms prohibiting any unfair treatment or misuse of the needy. Okay? Israel was wronged and oppressed in Egypt. And now that they're a nation of their own right and they're going to have their own land, it might be very easy for them to in turn oppress and wrong those beneath them because finally they're the ones in power, right? Now we get to do things our way. Okay, God's saying, no, you can't do that. You need to remember your time in Egypt and you need to be sympathetic and kind to strangers and offer them the hope that God has offered you, that they can be holy. Okay, they're to proclaim God's truth to the world, and they were to be different than the nations around them. Okay, all the nations around them had no problem oppressing the strangers and the outsiders among them. Okay, Israel was to be different. Verse 22 includes widows or orphans, and all three of these, strangers, widows, orphans, do not have the natural, normal protections that everybody else would. Strangers would lack citizenship and legal standing. Right? Widows had no husband to represent them legally or provide for them. And obviously orphans had no parents to take care of them. Okay. So all three of these groups are very easy to exploit. Verse 23 to 24, if you afflict him at all, and if he does cry out to me, I will surely hear his cry, and my anger will be kindled, and I will kill you with the sword, and your wives shall become widows, and your children fatherless. Okay, it says, if you afflict him at all, and he does cry out to me, what should that remind us of? Where else have we heard about crying out in the book of Exodus? Right. But still, right. First they cry out, right? And they are just crying out of desperation. They're not even necessarily crying out to Yahweh. I think it's chapter 2, but it says God heard their cry. They're not even asking him for help and God hears them. And then later, yes, they cry out to Pharaoh because he's making their lives so miserable. But just like Israel cries out and God hears their cry, if the stranger, orphan, or widow cries out, God is going to hear their cry. Okay? And so basically, if Israel, God is saying, Israel, if you become like Egypt and you oppress the orphan, the widow, and the stranger, God is going to treat you like Egypt. God is going to unleash the covenant curses on you. And these can be found in Leviticus 26. Deuteronomy 28, where we get a whole long list of them. What is going to happen to Israel if they do not obey the covenant? And this is part of the covenant. So that's Leviticus 26 and Deuteronomy 28. Okay? If they do not live out the theology of the Exodus, God is going to treat them like he treated Egypt. He says, I will kill you with the sword. And this is It means warfare. He is going to allow their enemies to come in and attack them and exterminate them. And he says, your wives shall become widows and your children fatherless. So basically, if you do not treat the stranger, the orphan, and the widow like you're supposed to, you're going to become a stranger, a widow, and an orphan. Okay? You're going to die or become exiled in a foreign land. And then you're going to die and your wives are going to be left alone and your children will have no parents. Okay. So they will become exactly like the people that they have oppressed. Okay. Verse 25 through 27, these go back to theft. Okay. Remember we had theft, adultery, theft. So this is the end of our first chiasm, verse 25 to 27, back to theft. Okay, verse 25, if you lend money to my people, to the poor among you, you are not to act as a creditor to him. You shall not charge him interest. Okay, so God is saying you have to represent who I am and my holiness, even in your business practices. Okay, borrowing and lending money are allowed. Those things are not illegal. What is illegal is charging of interest. This is a form of theft. You are taking from somebody more than you lent them. Okay? This is going to be repeated in Leviticus 25, 36 to 37, and Deuteronomy 23, 19 to 20. Okay? And this verse specifically identifies the poor. But in Leviticus and Deuteronomy, it's clear you can't charge any Israelite interest. Okay, it's not just the poor. If there's any sort of loan, you cannot charge interest. Any amount of interest is usury because the normal rate of interest is zero. Okay? Yes. Yes. Leviticus 25, 36 to 37. And Deuteronomy 23, 19 to 20. Okay? So here, interest becomes a form of theft. You are taking back more money than you should. Verse 22, you shall not, oh, sorry, not 22, 26. If you ever take your neighbor's cloak as a pledge, you are to return it to him before the sun sets, for that is his only covering. It is his cloak for his body. What else shall he sleep in? And it shall come out about that when he cries out to me, I will hear him, for I am gracious. Okay, so here we do have a distinction between the rich and the poor. When you make a loan, you are not allowed to charge interest. However, what you can do is you can ask for some sort of collateral or some sort of surety that they will pay the money back. Okay? if you are rich, you can afford, or, you know, at least, you know, middle class, you can probably afford to put something up for collateral that is not an essential item to your life that you need for everyday living. Okay? If you are poor, you have nothing but the essentials. And so whatever you put up as collateral is going to be something that you need for day-to-day life that you cannot do without because you don't have anything. Okay? So if you, as the lender, are taking something from the poor that is necessary to their survival, God views that as theft. You are stealing from them because they need it. He needs his cloak to sleep in. He has nothing else to sleep in. So either you didn't charge any collateral, okay, you just took their word that they were going to pay the loan, or you had to return that whatever essential item at the time of day whenever they needed that essential item. So here the example is a cloak. You're to give it back to him when the sun sets so that he can sleep because he has no blanket, no other covering for his body when he sleeps. Okay, so you had to be considerate to the poor and their needs and what they needed to survive each day. Okay. And God himself is the enforcer of this law, right? Verse 27, and it shall come about that when he cries out to me, I will hear him, for I am gracious. Okay, so God is going to be the one listening, and if the poor is abused, it's going to be God that's going to come and act on his behalf. Okay, so fear of God should make people obey this law. All right, verse 28, this starts our next chiasm, which goes into chapter 23. And this is going to be basically commands 1 and 5. 28, you shall not curse God nor curse a ruler of your people. Okay, so basically we have to honor God, right? No other gods before me. And God's established authorities, right? Command 5 is honor your father and mother. But we said that that's parallel to verses command 1 and 2 because God has established the father and the mother as the authorities in your life. Okay? God has also established rulers as authority in your life. Okay? We have to respect God's holiness in our words. Okay? God puts a limit on our free speech. We're not allowed to curse God. And we're not allowed to curse the rulers that he has put in place. And this is any leader. This is not just necessarily a national leader. Anybody who, you know, this could be a boss. Anybody who has authority over you, good, bad, or otherwise, God has put there on purpose. Okay? Nobody comes to be a leader by accident. That doesn't mean that all leaders are great and good. And serve and respect God. God puts men into leadership and women into leadership that hate him, that curse him, okay? But he has his purposes. Okay, this is repeated in Romans 13, 1 through 7, okay, where Paul says this, that we are to obey the government. We are to obey our leaders. And if you think about it, does anyone know who was Caesar when Paul wrote this? I think it was Nero. Really, any Caesar. Didn't matter. They were all bad. Okay? But, so it's not like the government was great during Paul's time when he wrote this. Okay? It's not like they had a great government that feared God and did everything right. Okay? It was a wretched, evil, worldly government. Okay? So we are not allowed to curse our leaders as well. Okay, because to curse a leader really is to indirectly curse God because it is God that has put him there. Now, this doesn't not mean that we can't oppose a leader, right? And in our nation, we, the people, have a certain amount of power in our elected officials, right? So we should do our part. But God is still the one in control, and he will put in leadership those he wants in leadership to accomplish his purpose. And we are not allowed to curse our leaders. Which sometimes that's easier than other times to obey. Verse 29, You shall not delay the offering from your harvest in your vintage. The firstborn of your sons you shall give to me. You shall do the same with your oxen, with your sheep. It shall be with its mother 7 days. On the eighth day you shall give it to me. Okay, this is going to be command 10. Command 10 was do not covet. Okay, and remember this paralleled command 4, which was keep the Sabbath day. And when we talked about the Ten Commandments, we said the big idea behind this is God is sovereign over everything. Keeping the Sabbath day, God is sovereign over your time. Do not covet. God has given you what he has given you. He is sovereign over everything that you have. You are not to be discontent and want something that God has not given you. So here we have, you shall not delay the offering from your harvest in your vintage. The firstborn of your sons you shall give to me. Okay, so you are to keep the rules of tithe. The first fruits go to God. And the firstborn, okay? You cannot covet these things. You cannot say, I want them. I don't want to give them to God. They are what is due to God, okay? So because God already owns everything, he is sovereign over all our stuff. We have to be content, and we have to follow his rules of tithing and of offering the firstborns. And when I say we, I mean the Israelites, okay? Withholding what is due to God was a direct act of defiance. Okay? They were to give God of their first and their best. And so he was sovereign over all those, over all their things, and they were to show that by their obedience. Okay? They were allowed to redeem, obviously, their firstborn, but then the firstborn of their oxen and sheep, they were to sacrifice to the Lord. Okay? God allows the oxen and sheep to stay with their mother, you know, 7 days to be kind to the mother and to the animal, but then you could not delay beyond the 7 days. Okay. So if, you know, you had your firstborn son, male oxen, the firstborn, it could stay with its mother 7 days, but on the eighth day, it had to be sacrificed and given to God. Verse 31, you shall be holy men to me. Therefore, you shall not eat any flesh torn to pieces in the field. You shall throw it to the dogs. Okay, so here God is sovereign over what Israel eats. We're going to see more of that later. Okay, so God cared down to the nitty-gritty details of Israel's life, down to what they ate. Okay, if they eat an animal that's been torn to pieces, the blood has not been properly drained, there's blood in the meat, they're not to eat blood. Also, just practically speaking, right, this kind of meat was easily contaminated, would be dirty and unclean. They had no, you know, process of refrigeration or anything back then, and it could easily make the eater sick, okay? But the idea here is God gets to determine what you eat and what you don't eat, okay? He is sovereign over your entire life. He dictates your time. He dictates your stuff, and now here he's even going to dictate what you eat. Okay. Questions, chapter 22. Yes.
What did it mean to give their first sons to the Lord? Did that have something to do with circumcision or what?
No. So all their sons would be circumcised on day eight. To give their first sons to the Lord, this is, it's to remember plague 10, when God spared the firstborn sons of Israel. And so God required that all firstborn animals, well, all clean firstborn animals were sacrificed. And then all firstborn sons and all firstborn unclean animals that you couldn't eat had to be redeemed. So they had to be bought back. So you had to bring another sacrifice to the Lord to buy your firstborn son back. So each firstborn son belonged to the Lord and should theoretically be sacrificed. But obviously God does not allow human sacrifice. So then the family had to buy it back. So if you remember, Joseph and Mary with Jesus, they go and they offer the two pigeons to buy Jesus back because he's their firstborn son. And so there was a different pricing structure based on how wealthy you were. So Mary and Joseph were poor, so they bring the poor people's offering. Yes. Good question. Any other questions? Yeah.
They replaced the firstborn sons, and so then the family
Yes, yes.
Yes,
yes. So the God, instead of taking everybody's firstborn son, he just took one tribe to be his and to serve him. Yes, that's right, Mom. Good. Anything else? All right. I will pray and we will be done. Dear Father in heaven, we thank you for your law. And we thank you that we can see a loving, kind, just, sovereign God behind it, Lord. And as we study your law, we can see that your ways truly are the best. And we long for the day when Christ will return and set this world to right. Because we know that your judgments are always true. And nothing can fool you because you know the hearts of man. You cannot be deceived. Lord, so we long for the day when you will rule here and set right all the wrongs that have been done. Thank you for these ladies coming out to study with me. I pray that, Lord, during this time, as we are isolated from each other, that you would strengthen our hearts, that we would draw closer to you. And, Lord, we ask if it is your will that this time would not last much longer, but that we would be allowed to gather together and to come together as a body to be able to worship you again, Lord. We love you. Thank you for your word. Thank you for your revelation to us. In Jesus' name, amen.